Welcome to Washington in Focus, your source for the week's top stories in the state of Washington. I'm Cole Lauterbach, managing editor for the Center Square Newswire service. This week, we'll be discussing the lack of discussion about billionaire Jeff Bezos leaving the state in revenue meetings, a threat of devastation if voters choose to repeal Washington's capital gains tax, Amazon's continued shift of workers out of Seattle after city officials make them more expensive to be employed, and Spokane officials hesitant to allow beer gardens on public thoroughfares. That's ahead on Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach.
Knowledge is power, and you deserve to know what happens in your state government. That's why the nonprofit Franklin News Foundation is bringing you straight news journalism through the Center Square, reporting on state authorities and publishing stories that show where your money goes and who spends it. By supporting the Center Square, you can track politicians' use of taxpayer money and demand transparency from elected officials. This is how we can equip everyday Americans to hold their government accountable. Become a supporter of Franklin today at franklinnews.org/donate.
Welcome back to Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach. Now, let's jump into the headlines. In a story we've been tracking for some time now, Washington's capital gains tax is one that is seen as extremely volatile because it relies on compliance of a small group of wealthy residents to pay up. The tax made headlines nationally when billionaire Amazon founder Jeff Bezos stopped selling off stock, only to start up again once he declared himself a Floridian. Capital reporter Carlene Johnson sat in on the state's annual revenue update. Carlene, how quickly did Bezos' departure and subsequent fallout of the revenue come up in the meeting?
Not really until our question, to be honest, asking specifically about his departure. Now, when he left in November, you know, speculation was this is going to hurt. Well, then when they had to readjust the capital gains revenue coming in, there's obviously a huge hit. So there's been multiple stories, including our own at the Center Square, that, you know, his decision not to sell off any stock this last year and then exit to Florida costs in excess of $600 million in anticipated capital gains tax revenue coming in. And so when that question was asked, there was a lot of dancing around in the initial answers.
Now, you followed up after there was no, like you said, there was no real response of it in the meeting. You went and asked Democrats who ran the show in their other news conference, correct?
Yeah, I did. I followed up with it with majority leaders for the Senate and the House in the Democrats' media availability this week. And basically was told, you know, we understand that this tax is going to be volatile. We understand that, you know, there'll be fluctuations as people come and go. But the big overriding theme from the majority Democrats was, if in fact the capital gains measure is overturned by voters in November, that, you know, the sky will fall. That all of the money that goes in, the first $500 million is guaranteed for an education fund, no matter what. But anything beyond that, you know, that it goes to, it will be devastating, as you mentioned, for the state of Washington. And that's one of the reasons they cite for saying we will not, under any circumstance, hold a public hearing for the capital gains initiative.
Right. And that's just delaying the inevitable, really, because they can't stop it from making it to the ballot. They can only propose an alternative to be placed next to it. But with what we know about Bezos' actions being, you know, selling billions of dollars worth of stock just before the tax, the capital gains tax took effect, stopping, with the exception of a couple charitable donations of stock when it was active, moving to Florida, and then announcing, what, 6 days after he'd sell billions worth. How are we to listen to his excuse, you know, to only his excuse of being closer to family? But, you know, lawmakers gave you this befuddling comment about the fact that, you know, 1 + 1 might not equal 2 here.
Yes. Yeah. And that was a follow up. So Democrat Representative April Berg offered that following the comment that was made by the chair, Republican Linda Wilson. She said, wait a minute. We know that he left because of the tax, basically. We know, you know, she said he won't come right out and say it, but she has another billionaire, apparently, in her district who she said, we know at least two have left because I know one of them personally. And he told me if, in fact, an income tax, which Republicans say capital gains is an income tax, not an excise tax, she says, he's told me for years he would leave if anything like this ever happened. And he did. So we, she said, you know, we know at least two of them are gone. And then keep in mind, too, Bezos accounts alone for what a huge percentage of what they're expecting from capital gain. So his exit is killing their whole plan. They don't want to admit to it, but it is, in fact, what's happening.
Right. And at the same time, this has happened before, where in New Jersey, the billionaire owner, this Russian guy that owned the Nets, he left the state and blew a hole in New Jersey's state budget because they had a highly progressive, thus highly volatile tax like this. And it was, you know, like you mentioned here, the sky is falling. And they had to figure out how to fill this massive hole. And it always makes me wonder, do they assume that this is not going to be something that influences the behavior of people who, if anyone, have the means to no longer classify themselves as a resident of Washington? Because it's not like he has to Carmen San Diego his entire mansion all the way off to Florida. It's as simple as getting a new license in Florida, getting a new dentist, and checking the other boxes that his, highly paid accountant will tell him to do in order to say, you can't tax me anymore. I am not a Washington resident. And this these others we're seeing, it was something else that was really revealing in the release, I believe it was by the Washington Republicans, that said, in addition to this accounting error that they had touched on, we're also seeing an outsized number of these capital gains qualified wealthy Washingtonians that are filing for extensions.
Yes,
and they're
absolutely not
filing their taxes and paying up right away. What they're doing is waiting until either this fall or the next year, 2025, to file their taxes and pay what's owed. And, you know, if the volatility isn't bad enough, pushing it off until after the ballot initiative could repeal the entire thing creates even more question marks. So this is something that we'll definitely be watching. And Carlene, thank you so much for being in the meeting and asking the important questions that they were not willing to address outright.
You bet.
So now we head to Seattle, where Amazon is pulling people out of its Seattle headquarters. City reporter Spencer Pauley joins the program. Now, Spencer, where are Amazon employees being sent specifically? Is this another Florida destination?
It is not. It's actually just right across Lake Washington over to the city of Bellevue. Throughout the Puget Sound region, Amazon is transferring about 1,000 of its employees over to the newest building that it's opened up in Bellevue, which marks its ninth. And that now creates this group of about 12,000 employees that now work in Bellevue for Amazon.
Now, Amazon HQ still, I mean, it's still the big headquarters, though, right? It's you know, there's tens of thousands of workers in the city of Seattle.
Yes. Yes. Amazon's headquarters in Seattle still has more workers. An Amazon spokesperson gave me context telling me that the company has about 50,000 corporate employees based in Seattle. Just in context, across Amazon's network of about 18 tech hubs throughout all of North America, the company has over 70,000 corporate employees, so Seattle still has a huge good chunk of that. I will add that at some point, Bellevue is expected to have about 25,000 corporate employees by the time Amazon's done building up more buildings for its employees. So I don't know how much that will affect Seattle's headquarters. I don't know how much the number of employees will drop, but it does seem like they're still trying to grow a presence in Bellevue.
Right. And if they're actively moving employees, you have to imagine that they're not fighting the attrition, where a company of this size, you're going to have a major churn and you'll see them either not rehire the employee there or hire a new employee in Bellevue or in Texas or somewhere like that as well. Now, what's the company's reason, Spencer, for shifting these thousands of employees outside of their existing office space? Because it's not like they don't have the acreage in Seattle.
Well, according to Amazon, its expansion into Bellevue is part of a natural progression of the company's growth in the Puget Sound region. But I will note that the company was influenced by Bellevue's availability space of space and a, quote, more business-friendly community.
That is economic development code for we're not under such a government burden in this location as compared to other options, which is very similar to the language they used when it was Virginia was chosen as HQ2 out of the big sweepstakes of tax incentives that cities were throwing at them, even letting them create their own unit of government that would essentially act as like a tax haven zone in the middle of the counties, one of which I covered back in Illinois years ago. Now, our city officials in Seattle, you know, they have to see this. You know, their economic development experts there, I can't imagine would not look at this and start to spark that conversation with the city council. Are they getting the hint explain, you know, the head tax first off? Give me an idea of just how expensive it is to employ an employee in Seattle.
Yeah, so Seattle has its jumpstart payroll tax, which is basically a tax on businesses with at least $7 million in annual payroll, and they have to pay a tax for each employee that makes at least $150,000 a year. And so Seattle officials have had that discussion on record about, you know, if this was a mistake, because we're starting to see more of these tech hubs moving outside of downtown Seattle, as we're seeing moving into Bellevue. And I will say that, you know, Bellevue is really welcoming this public-private partnership with open arms. And from what I know, the city still has no plans to implement any sort of head tax similar to Seattle, kind of seeing what's going on with the payroll tax in Seattle.
Right. Yeah, they're aggressive, right?
Yeah. And I will note that, you know, there is a potential payroll tax measure that could appear on voters' ballots this coming November. So while we're talking about, are we going to, you know, pull back some of these, you know, progressive taxes, it seems like a lot of Seattle residents are still looking at Amazon saying, you know, pay up for this. This new ballot measure that we could possibly see in the future here would levy a 5% compensation tax on employers for each worker that makes over $1 million a year. And that money would go towards the acquisition and construction of social housing in Seattle. And Amazon would be subject to that as well.
It's full speed ahead, essentially, if this new ballot proposition does become the law of the land there. Okay. Well, yes. We'll keep an eye on that. Thank you so much, Spencer. Appreciate it. We swing back briefly now to Olympia, where editor Brett Davis has a story about the dire predictions that Carlene mentioned earlier from state Democrats should voters decide that the capital gains tax they sent Governor Jay Inslee to enact a few years ago should be scrapped. First, Brett, educate us on a little description of who pays this tax, how much, and when.
Right. So the Department of Revenue, they've estimated that about 7,000 households, that would be the wealthiest in the state, would be affected by the capital gains tax, which is a 7% tax on the sale of financial assets like stocks and bonds above $250,000. The capital gains tax return is due at the same time as an individual's federal income tax return, at least in theory.
So you have in this, you know, in terms of the total dynamics and laws of economics, you have a very narrow tax. You have a very small amount of people that will pay the tax. And what we've seen, as we saw earlier, people will go to lengths to try and get around it, as they do a lot of other tax. It becomes the old adage about where if you've got enough money, you don't have to pay as much taxes on it because you can get creative. Now, what was the prognostication from supporters of the tax this week about this potential, the potential repealing of the tax, which we're seeing in polls is not necessarily as popular as they think?
Right. So the Department of Revenue did an analysis of Initiative 2109, which would scrap the capital gains tax. And it found that that would result in a reduction of more than $5.6 billion, that's billion with a B, in funding for early learning, childcare, and K-12 education programs across the state by 2029. This got a reaction out of some Democrats. Senate Majority Leader Andy Billig was apoplectic in a statement he put out. He said the figure was worse than we thought. I assume he means Democrats. It was worse than they thought it was going to be. And he said, quote, that the initiative would, quote, devastate early learning and childcare programs relied on by families across Washington. You know, he said it would hit parents hard. It would hit businesses hard. So he went all out on condemning it. Something interesting in his statement, he also mentioned, he said the capital gains tax is paid by only about 3,300 of the richest households in our state, which doesn't jibe with the DOR's 7,000 households. I just realized that this morning, so that might be something worth looking into. I'm not sure about the discrepancy in that figure.
That is interesting. My question is, and he talks about the thought that, well, our education system is going to be, you know, what sounds like direly, underfunded, where things are
going to blow a huge hole in the education budget.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, give a little bit of a comparison. Are Washington schools underfunded comparative to other states?
Not from what I found. Actually, this is, I found this kind of unbelievable going back and looking, but state spending on K through 12 schools has doubled here in Washington in the last 10 years. Back in the 2013-2015 biennium, it was $15.3 billion. And during the current 2023-25 biennium, it's a whopping $30.7 billion. So it's, you know, it's practically doubled in the last 10 years.
So per student, you're well above other states. You're not Connecticut, which is like 20-some thousand per student. But then again, you're not exactly New Mexico either.
Right. We're pretty high up on the list, as I recall.
Right. And now, so we often, with the dynamic of things like this, we often see state or local officials give what is considered like a dire prediction of any type of revenue cut. If there's a ballot proposition up, or there's a motion to pass or extend a new tax, they'll say, hey, you know, if we don't see this, if this revenue gets cut, if this money that belongs to us goes away, we're going, the first thing that gets cut are police or firefighters or teachers lose their pay, 60 kids in a classroom. If they don't get to keep the revenue stream in question. Did you speak to anybody that brought up the fact that this sounds like a familiar song?
I did. I reached out to Liv Finney. She's the director of the Center for Education at the Washington Policy Center. And she basically said money is not the problem here. She said Democrats often threaten to cut funding in public schools as a scare tactic, but they don't actually follow through. That would seem to be borne out by the budget figures I mentioned over the last 10 years. You know, they talk a big game about cutting funding, but it doesn't really seem to happen. It always seems to go, to public schools. They don't seem to be underfunded.
And being that this is, 2 years of revenue collection at this point, right? I mean, this is only a couple years old. What begs the question for me is that this is not a decades old revenue stream that districts have learned to, put in, bake into their normal budget every year for the past.
Have been relying on this tax for a long time, as it hasn't
exactly
been around that long.
It begs the question to me, like, what happened before 2021 or 2022 when this all of a sudden this revenue started showing up? Schools weren't that bad off then.
Right.
Presumably.
The state funding is, essentially doubled over the last 10 years, but have test scores, for example, improved in similar fashion over the past decade? I don't think so. There was the nonpartisan Washington State Institute for Public Policy came out with a report late last year that found average math and English language arts test scores in Washington were lower in 2022 than average scores before the pandemic. And the math scores fell more than ELA scores. So, what have we been getting for our money, and what is more money?
Yeah, that's a tricky causality though, because with COVID and remote learning imposed by our state leaders, you saw across the country significant levels of learning loss for students who just did not translate into being at home staring into a computer as compared to being in a classroom setting with a teacher with attentive assistants. But then again, what are you going to get from trying to tell a kindergartner to print out a PDF? It's just one of those things that just happens.
My kid during the pandemic, I didn't have to get on him to do his homework. Actually, we just get on the computer and do it. I know he might be an outlier, but man, lucky me.
Mine was in kindergarten in 2020, and that was a rough year. Let's just say that. But anyway, thank you, Brett. We will continue to track this and the situation as it develops along through the legislative inaction, I suppose.
No doubt.
Say. Off to Spokane we go, where city council members have put the brakes on what seemed like a popular initiative that would have allowed a staple of county fairs and small town homecomings across the country. Beer gardens. Eastern Washington reporter Randy Brock joins us. Randy, what specifically would this ordinance propose this week? And then I guess they kind of hit the brakes a little bit. What would it have done?
What the council did on Monday was to defer action on their own proposed amendments to the current city code, which governs events at which alcohol is being served. And Monday's deferral is going to be considered again at their February 26 meeting. It was actually the second time the council has passed on it since early January. Basically, what the council is considering is allowing approved applicants to set up beer gardens in public rights of way that can admit both adults and minors. Presumably, if that's permitted, you might see a city street blocked off during some type of summer festival or event to allow an enclosed beer garden to be set up that adults and children accompanied by adults could enter.
Now, who would be interested in holding an event like this? Randy, what would be the purpose?
Well, it could be like a business or business-related group, such as a chamber of commerce function. It might be a nonprofit organization. Most likely, the purpose would be a fundraiser, something that makes money for the sponsoring organization.
Oh, okay. So, all right, that makes a lot more sense. In terms of, you know, the types of functions that are allowed in these places, right now, there's in Spokane, there's a popular wine walk. Downtown has their sip and shop events, art shows, those type of things. This, though, would be a little bit different, correct?
Correct. You know, most of those types of events cater kind of to an adults-only crowd, maybe where age ID is checked at the door and the patrons get a ticket or a wristband that easily allows a server to know that that patron is of legal drinking age. Those types of events might allow an unrestricted flow of foot traffic as opposed to a beer garden that occupies a fixed public space.
Right. So you're talking, you know, this then gets into like the town homecomings, what I had in my hometown growing up, where there's rides and there's cotton candy. I mean, it's like a carnival type atmosphere. But then off in the corner, you have a, you know, orange, you know, snow fenced off beer tent. And that, you know, so that's what this really does seem more like. So the draft ordinance amendment. Now, could you explain why the delays in this?
Well, council members have said they want to get the language right. And, you know, I don't know that they're reinventing the wheel here, but those discussions are continuing with some input from representatives from the business and community interests. The council thinks its own existing, and they call it the family-friendly festivals ordinance, is currently too restrictive. And they're looking at incorporating language that's spelled out by the State Liquor and Cannabis Control Board, which has to approve a permit for any hosting organization anyway. So on Monday, there was this discussion on whether all adults 21 or older entering a beer garden should be identified by a wristband, or if it's just adults who intend to consume alcohol, how that identification process could work and whether it could be streamlined. Also, one councilman wanted to spell out specific language that would enable Spokane police to shut down an event if any problems arose. But the draft ordinance as it stands now says the city would be generally supportive of the beer garden concept.
Right. And it would allow police to, yeah, like you said, they would be able to shut down the event. And we heard a little bit of, you know, opposition there, you know, the thought of, say, you know, a three-year-old walking into an environment that's made for making money and at a beer garden type thing, you know, but I think that there probably is going to be some kind of common ground there that you have to imagine that they would come to. I'm curious about why the delay in this, or if there's some type of political threat where, you know, they're going to see flyers next November or something like that showing people are letting three-year-olds get drunk in beer gardens in Spokane, and they allowed this, vote for the opponent. So we'll track this. Thanks so much, Randy. I appreciate the fun conversation on beer gardens and reminding me of my childhood homecomings back at home. And a big thank you to all of our journalists for sharing their stories. Stay up to date with these and more at thecentersquare.com. I'm Cole Lauterbach, and until next time, this has been Washington in Focus.